White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Good evening, listeners and students of the International Jew. Welcome to episode 19 on November 1st, 2012. I am Carolyn Yeager, here with Hadding Scott.
Hello.
And we will be bringing you the rest of chapter 15, Is the Jewish Kahal the Modern Soviet? Yes. We did about a fifth of it last week, so we have the bulk of that left to do, which should be just about right for one program. And so, to recap from last week, the writers quoted, one thing they did was quote from the 17th Protocol as an example of the similarity of the two institutions, the Jewish Kahal and the modern Soviet, those things that were organized in Russia by the Bolsheviks. And it, from the protocol it is, even now our brothers are under obligation to denounce apostates of their own family, or any person known to be opposed to the Kahal. When our kingdom comes, it will be necessary for all subjects to serve the state in a similar manner. Well, I have a little more to emphasize that, but you can see how, you know, I think this shows the similarity, because this, in the Soviet Union, these Soviet councils and so on were very, very strict. And of course, we, at least from what we've been told, they were encouraged to denounce their own family members and so on if they weren't following good Soviet policy, and everybody had to do it. No exceptions. Absolutely. There was no democracy. There was no ability to have different viewpoints. Everybody had to, you know, go along with this. And this is in a large way what they attribute to the National Socialist regime in Germany, that they forced everybody into some kind of a, you know, same thinking, and that they encourage kids to denounce their parents and so on, which this is another one of these projection things and these turnaround things, where the people who were actually doing it, the Jews and the Soviets, they were the Jews, turn it around and try to put it on those who they consider their enemies. So that's just a little aside, but, the part that we did last week also described the bitterness of the total rejection of the entire Jewish community, or the, what they would call the Kahal, that's led by the Kahal. I don't know, sometimes the whole community was called a Kahal, and the council that ran it was also the Kahal. But, such a person, they would just reject so utterly and totally with such force and hatred that it was a horrible experience for people who were rejected from the Jewish community, because they decided they weren't going to go along with all the little tiny laws and everything they were supposed to follow. And they used as an example this famous philosopher Baruch Spinoza, who this was done to. And it was really, if you missed that, I hope you go back and listen to last week's program to hear that, because it's really amazing the way they do this, and we're not going to repeat it tonight. So tonight, Hadding is going to start with where we left off, and we left off at, I've got here that you will start with after the destruction of the Jewish state. Okay.
That's right.
After the destruction of the Jewish state by the Romans, the Jews maintained a center in the Patriarch. And after the dispersion of the Jews out of Palestine, this center of nationality was preserved in the Prince of the Exile, or Exilarch, an office which is believed to persist to the present time, and which some believe to be held now by an American Jew. In spite of all assertions to the contrary, the Jews have never ceased to be a people. that is, a consciously united racial group, different from all others, and with purposes and ideals which are strictly of the Jews, by the Jews, and for the Jews, in distinction from the rest of the world. That they constitute a nation within the nations, the most responsible Jewish thinkers not only declare, but insist upon. And this is wholly in accord with the facts as observed. The Jew not only desires to live apart from other people, but he works with his own people as against others. And he desires as much as possible to live under his own laws. In the city of New York today, the Jews have succeeded in establishing their own court for the settlement of their own questions according to their own laws. And that is precisely the principle of the Soviet Kahal.
All right, let me break in here, if I might. And I looked into this courts, having courts of their own, and I did find out about it. In fact, I've probably got too much. I used a picture of one on the... for the program page, because it was the most interesting picture, and I talked about it some, but, you know, they really do have these courts where they can settle their own questions according to their own laws, and they're called Beth Dins, and there's a Beth Din of America rabbinical court in New York City, and, you know, you can go to it at www.bethdin.org. They adjudicate commercial, communal, and matrimonial conflicts, and rabbis do it, and they're decided under Jewish law through the prism of contemporary commercial practice and secular law. A lot of Jews want to get divorces through this, even though they have to get divorced through the regular, civil courts too, but they do this, and supposedly they're overseen by sensitive rabbis and so on, and I think they're encouraged to do it, and it costs quite a bit of money, so you know, they could up to $1,000 probably to get your divorce taken care of in the Jewish court, because they have a lot of extra little fees and so on, and then you have to whatever it costs you in the civil national courts. So, you know, it's another money-making scheme, but it's interesting, don't you think, Hadding, that they have succeeded in having these, being able to keep these courts, whereas we're supposedly, nobody's supposed to be able to do that, and the Muslims want to have that too.
Well, do they actually replace
No, they don't, no. No, they can't. They have to follow, whatever they come up with has to follow the civil law.
Yeah, so that's what they really would like, though, I'm sure, would be to have
sure they would.
Crimes involving Jews be tried in the Jewish court.
Oh, yeah.
I think in Rome they got away with that. I'm not absolutely sure about it, but I believe so.
But it's just an example of how they do want to have their own ways in their own community. You know, they go back, you know, and they have these old big law books and so on from the old days, and so the Talmud, I don't know what they're going, they show pictures of them sitting around there with these big books open, and they're deciding these issues, whatever. It's all kind of ridiculous, but it's of course totally reformed Jews don't bother with that. It's the Orthodox that cling to that. All right.
I guess they would use their court for things like deciding who is a Moser or not, and who is going to be excommunicated and things like that.
Yeah, I don't know. They say they have some of it is commercial stuff like real estate and so on. Uh-huh. And then they have the matrimonial is a big part of it.
Okay.
And divorce and complex issues. Oh, here it is. Advice regarding complex issues under Jewish law, including heter iska, which is structuring of loans, naturally, estate planning, and determination of Jewish legal status of individuals, such as marital and Cohen status, like if you're Cohen, you know,
yeah.
If you're of the priest class or whatever, though they decide all that stuff. That's of interest to Jews.
All right.
Okay.
From the first century forward, as any reader can see by consulting the Jewish Encyclopedia, the community, assembly, or kahal, has been the center of Jewish life. It was so earlier in the time of the Babylonian captivity, and the last official appearance of it was at the peace conference, where the Jews, in accordance with their world program, the only program that passed successfully and unchanged through the peace conference, secured for themselves the right to the kahal for administrative and cultural purposes, in addition to many other privileges in countries where their activities had been a matter of protest.
Well, I think it's important that they mention here the peace conference in relationship to the world program. And they mention the world program at least a couple more times. So, you know, they're not giving up on that idea at all, that there is a Jewish world program. And they, of course, again, we've talked about in the past how they link this, the Paris Peace Conference after World War I is considered very essential to all of this, and they were very successful at it, and they got everything they wanted. Their program was the only one that was unchanged throughout the peace conference. So it says here.
The Polish question is purely a Jewish question, and Paderewski's failure as a statesman was entirely due to his domination by Jewish influences. The Romanian question is likewise a Jewish question, and all Romanians speak of the United States as the Jews' country, because they know, through their statesmen, the terrible pressure which was exerted by American Jews against their country, a pressure extending to the very necessities of life, and which compelled Romania to sign agreements which are as humiliating as those which Austria asked of Serbia, out of which the World War grew.
What was it exactly that Austria asked of Serbia?
I don't know.
Well, that was after after the Serbian shot
No, I don't think so. They had
they wanted Serbia to do a whole lot to atone for that. And
well, there was a Serbian
minority.
They
didn't want to do it.
Austria, yeah. And there was conflict because of that.
Okay. Well, I didn't look that up, so I don't even know exactly what they're referring to here.
One great detail. The Jewish question is written all over the forces that provoked the war, and over all the hindrances to peace which the world has since seen, which is only like 2 years. Under the Kahal, or ancient Soviet, the Jews lived by themselves and governed themselves, doing business with the government solely through their representatives. It was communism in a more drastic form than has been seen anywhere in the world outside Russia. Education, health, taxes, domestic affairs, all were under the absolute control of a few men who constituted the ruling board.
Would you agree with that? Do you think that, and do you think that that is the way it was in the Congress of, in the Soviets, in the under the Bolsheviks?
Douglas Reed characterizes the Soviet Union as an extension of the Jewish ghetto to cover everybody in the whole country.
I guess
that it's really all that unique, this kind of social organization.
Naturally, there's social organizations. You know, there always have been. There's always going to be some. They're going to have a lot of things in common. But this one, where it was so absolute, now that people, I emphasize the idea, he said, under the absolute control of a few men, and we know that this was the case under the Bolsheviks, that the few men absolutely controlled everybody else, you know, in these areas that were under these councils. There were some pretty big areas, but they, you know, they had absolute leaders, and they were very vicious and, you know, demanding. And so they're saying that this is the way the Jews worked too, so they moved right into these Soviets with ease. Well, we'll get to that.
This board, as the present-day Jewish hierarchy is supposed to be, was self-perpetuating, the office often passing in an unbroken line of hereditary succession through many generations. All property was in common, which, however, did not prevent the leaders becoming rich. These kahals, or Soviets, existed in Rome, France, Holland, Germany, Austria, Russia, Denmark, Italy, Romania, Turkey, and England. In the United States, the idea has developed around the synagogue and around national and international secret societies of Jews, of which more will be said in succeeding articles. The Kahal is the traditional Jewish political institution during the dispersal of the race among the nations. Its international aspect is to be seen in the higher councils. These councils enlarged as the Jews spread over the world. The Jewish Encyclopedia cites the Council of Three Lands, the Council of Four Lands, the Council of Five Lands, showing an international relationship in earlier years. But like all such records, public view of them is not really accessible so far as they relate to modern times. The recent Zionist Congress in London, where doubtless much business was done that pertained to the Jewish people throughout the world. Oops.
Yeah.
Though not in public halls by any means, may be called the Council of 37 Lands. For the delegates to that Congress came from all parts of the world, from points remote as Lapland and South Africa, Persia and New Zealand. The purpose of these world councils was the unification of the Jews, and the records of their assemblages run back through the centuries.
Okay, so the Jewish Encyclopedia says that among the first councils was the Council of Three Lands, so they only had representatives from three different countries, I guess. And then they had representatives from four countries, then from five, and then eventually, as you see, they're talking about 37. Now they'd have them, when they still have these meetings, they'd have them from, you know, even more, I imagine.
Yeah. It is therefore no new thing that has arisen in Russia. It is the imposition by the Jewish revolutionists upon Gentile Russia of a form of control in which Judaism has been schooled from earliest times of its contact with the world. Soviet Russia could not have been possible had not 90% of the commissars been Jewish. Soviet Hungary could not have been possible had not Béla Kun, the chief Red, been a Jew, and had not 18 of his 24 commissars been Jews. The Jews are the only group schooled in the erection and administration of the Kahal.
Yep.
And
yes or no?
I have a couple of comments there. That there are we talked about this Männerbund, the Society of Men, which would be things like Freemasonry. And those organizations like that give the same kind of schooling to non-Jews, which is probably why the Ku Klux Klan was populated primarily with Freemasons when it started.
Well, the Jews you're talking about the Freemasons did the same. The Jews were involved in the Freemasons right from the beginning.
I'm not sure that they were involved right from the beginning.
Well, there were Jewish orders, and then there were non-Jewish orders. You're right, which eventually
I'm not sure that Blue Lodge Masonry, which is just the first 3 degrees, is of Jewish origin at all. I'm not sure that it is.
Yeah. Well, I would go along with that. I mean, not all of them were, especially in the beginning. But the Jews were, as far as we know, Weishaupt was the first one to bring about such a thing that became the Freemasons, right, with his Illuminati.
I don't know if he was or not. His Order of Illuminati is usually considered irregular Masonry, I think.
So well, that's because it was the first one, and then after that.
No, there was Freemasonry before that, and
there was
the Scottish Rite seems to have been started by Jews because it was. supposedly brought to North America by six or seven Jews, led by a Jew named Stephen Moran.
Yeah, and then look how they call it the Scottish Rite. It's just
yes.
So typical.
Well, they have to camouflage things somehow.
Okay.
Although this, I think the Scottish Rite today is not really a radical group. They're kind of maybe a little left of center, maybe.
We had a Scottish Rite, big Scottish Rite building in my hometown growing up.
Yeah. There's one right across the intersection from the state capitol in Denver, Colorado. It's right across the street.
No, I'm not surprised.
Across the intersection. The other point I wanted to make is that the Soviet system got out of Jewish control in a fairly short time. Jews had about, I mean, according to Heinrich Hertler, he was writing about about what the situation was around the time of the Second World War. A lot of the Soviets, a lot of the councils were about half Jewish by then. Some of them were much less than that.
That's still a lot. That's still
oh, sure
a lot.
It is. And, you know, even a minority of Jews, if they're very organized, which they will be, very organized and pushy, they'll get their way. But Stalin,
and then even after Stalin purged the Jews, later there were still a lot of them there.
Well, sure.
And so, you know, they were never gotten rid of. They weren't really gotten rid of, so at all. They're still there in Russia. But yeah, it's true that in the beginning, they were the ones who set the whole thing up. They're the ones who did the revolution. They're the ones who did all that murdering on the, you know, the horrendous scale that they did it, and so on, and all that terrorizing. And then slowly some of them were purged.
Well, there were a lot of them purged in 1938, but you know, a lot of them were loyal to Trotsky too, apparently. Trotsky the Jew. So it ended up, and they had this term for Jews in the Soviet Union, ruthless cosmopolitans.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a slowly growing tendency in the Soviet Union toward regarding Jews with suspicion. And there was that doctor's plot.
Yeah, well, okay. Right. Let's not go over that.
That's... And then there's the Wolf of the Kremlin, where the nephew of one of the Jews says that they killed Stalin. An Associated Press dispatch under date of August 12th, 1920, I guess, throws a light on the congeniality of the Soviet system and the Jewish mind. Speaking of the Polish towns and villages occupied by Bolshevik forces in their recent drive, the dispatch says, "The local Jewish parish populations already are said to be setting up Soviet and communist governments."
Okay, so now this was in Poland. Let's keep this straight. In Poland, the Jews were quite ready to set up the Soviets, he's saying.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, the Jews, they definitely rushed to the side of the Bolsheviks after the Bolsheviks prevailed. A lot of them did. Mm-hmm. Of course, yet this is in strange contrast with what we are constantly told through the press of the sufferings of the Jews under the Soviet form and of their abhorrence of the Reds. However, most of what we read concerning this in the public press is Jewish propaganda, pure and simple, and the reports of men on the spot contradict it all. One relief worker testifies that relief work in Poland is frequently hung up because some Jew landlord asks an exorbitant rent for his premises. While another testifies that though railroad fares in the supposedly famine-stricken districts have gone up 1,000%, the best and highest fare trains are exclusively occupied by Jews. He adds of his trip through Hungary, "The Hungarians have no mercy anymore, but the
no, money.
No money anymore, but the Jews have." But American Jews abhor Trotsky and Sovietism, is the plea sometimes made. Do they? Do Americans abhor American Jews, Abhor Trotsky, and Sovietism. On page 9 of the American Jewish World of July 30, a letter signed Mrs. Samuel Rush appears. It is headed, Are we really ashamed of Trotsky? Do you want to read this, or do you want me to read it?
I don't want you to read it like that.
Read a few excerpts from it.
Okay, I'll read it. Right. I have read, because I'll be Mrs. Samuel Rush. I have read of late several laments
sound
from
very Jewish.
Well, she probably doesn't. She's Mrs. Samuel Rush. I have read of late several laments from the editors of Jewish publications that the Jew is now libeled as a radical. It is true that many Jews are radicals. It is also true that some of the radical leaders are Jews. But before weeping over the downfall of the race, let's think a bit. Trotsky himself has never been represented as anything but a cultured man, a student of world economics, a powerful and efficient leader and thinker who will surely go down in history as one of the great men our race has given the world. Very few of us doubt any longer that behind the absurdities written about Russia is the great truth that Russia is in that unsettled state which attends reconstruction.
Always attends.
I don't have that in mind. I don't know what happened.
Okay.
There is a plan behind this seeming disorder, and out of the upheaval will come order. It will not be utopia, but as good as a government, but as good a government as the undoubtedly high-minded practical idealists, which I say that she's talking about Jews.
High-minded idealists.
Yeah, as good a government as the undoubtedly high-minded practical idealists. So the Jews are putting together as good a government as they can. They're so idealistic. They are building for Russia. Who are building for Russia can, well, I screwed up the sentence by adding Jews in there. Building for Russia can build with the necessary imperfect materials, human beings, with which they must work. So the imperfect human beings she's talking about are the Russians. And the high-minded practical idealists are the Jews who are putting together this government in Russia, which naturally has got some problems in the beginning because of this huge project that they've undertaken. Really something. She goes on, and one of the leaders is Leon Trotsky. Are we really ashamed of Trotsky?
The lady is evidently not ashamed of Trotsky, or Mr. Braunstein, as his real name is. Or take Judge Harry Fisher of Chicago. While drawing a salary for work in the court, Judge Fisher went abroad on Jewish relief work. His plans were changed somewhat after his departure, and he landed in Russia. He asserts in several interviews that he was permitted to arrive in Russia on condition that he leave political matters alone. There has been no such restriction placed upon him since his return to the United States, for he appears as an open advocate of full trade relations with the Soviet government of Russia. The Chicago Tribune thus quotes him. We must leave Russia alone, he said in summarizing his views. We should resume trade with the Soviet. The Bolshevist government is permanent. While there are only 700,000 members of the Communist Party, the peasants who represent almost 100 million people are solidly back of the Lenin regime. Among the Soviet devices which the 100 million peasants of Russia are said to be solidly back of is the following. It is particularly interesting in view of the fact that Judge Fisher is judge of the Morals Court of Chicago. Some time ago, it was published that the women of Russia had become national property, he said. That is untrue, but the case with which marriage and divorce with which marriage and divorce may be effected makes for rapid changes. Everyone wanting to marry goes to what we would call the city hall and registers. Inducements to marry are great. When people are hard-pressed for clothes and food, they sometimes make a pact to wed for a day. The next day, they go down to the city hall and register again. This time, their names are put side by side in the divorce book. That is all that is necessary to be divorced, and they have had a good feed in the bargain. Judge Harry Fisher of Chicago, who has returned from Jewish relief work abroad, evidently is one with the others in not being ashamed of Trotsky. Also, Max Pine, for many years Secretary of the United Hebrew Trades of New York, has been abroad in Soviet Russia as a labor delegate. He, too, had many good things to say about the Soviet, say of the Soviets, among other things, the strange contradiction that the Jews are doing very well in Russia, but are not pro-Bolshevik. Here are three persons from widely different spheres of life, yet each one of them indicates a natural liking for the Kahal or Soviet, an admiration of its methods, and a distinct good feeling toward its rulers. For Sovietism is the rankest form of autocracy, and the marriage laws of Soviet Russia are in full harmony with the program stated in the protocols.
Oh, the protocol says, we will break down the influence of family life among the Gentiles.
Whether the Soviet Kahals of Russia will succeed in completely undermining Russian family life is extremely doubtful. The weakness of Soviet rule is the same as that of the protocols, a moral weakness which must eat like a cancer until it destroys the institutions which it infests.
Well, they're saying in this, too, elsewhere, that they don't think it can succeed because it's so morally flawed. And something that's so morally flawed starts to just, destroy itself like a cancer. And also I wanted to mention about the autocracy here, because they just mention here that the Sovietism is the rankest form of autocracy. And I came up with the definition of autocrat I want to see what you think of it. One who rules through his own power.
Yeah, so, it's supposed to be one man rule by a man who's not accountable to anybody else. And it's hard to understand.
So if you're powerful enough, if you gain the power, then you're ruling through your own power. You're not ruling through any legitimacy that the population has given you.
Or council, even. It's not ruled by a council, really.
Okay. Well, that's the kind of strange thing. There's nobody who would be ruling totally alone. I mean, not anymore. So,
Stalin,
and they talked
of being an autocrat, but
yeah,
I'm not sure that they really had an autocrat before him.
Right now, but Jewish autocracy would be that Jews have the right to rule. This is one way you could look at it. Jews believe they do have the right to rule. They do believe that. Not every Jew you meet in the street, but the Jews that are behind all this stuff. Look at Rothschild. I mean, that whole type of Jew, and those who are far less powerful than that family. The rabbinical history is that the Jews are meant to rule by God, and they therefore they have the right to rule. So that's a kind of a Jewish autocracy. They don't expect anybody to give them that right. They just take it. They're going to just take it. They're in the process of taking it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's my little thing there.
Russia today, viewed in the light of the protocols, does not represent the Judaic state, but it represents the Gentile state seized by Jewish forces. There are three degrees of action set forth in the protocols. There is first the secret process of breaking up the integrity of society by the admixture of alluring but disruptive ideas. This is a work in which Gentile agitators are used.
Yeah, like the homosexual marriage and family. That's a good example of that.
when the ideas have worked sufficiently to break up society and explode in a crisis, then, as in Germany, the forces that have worked in secret come swiftly to the front to take the reins and guide the riot. In Germany, this immediately occurred upon the collapse which followed the armistice. But the Germans were wise enough to know the meaning of the influx of Jews into all the official positions of the former empire, and it was not long before they were politically ousted. See, you had the non-Jewish social democrats still in power at that point. In Russia, however, the Jews sprang immediately into official positions and have succeeded in remaining there. It began with Kerensky compelling the Tsar to lay aside his crown. It continues with Trotsky and his armies at the throat of Europe.
Well, so they have, they say they've got 2 points here, and there's going to be a third one, because I was trying to follow this. You said the 3 degrees of action set forth in the protocols, well, they're bringing up the protocols again. The first is a secret process of breaking up the integrity of society. And then once that has been done sufficiently, and society is pretty well broken up, then they go into, there's a crisis, and then they rush in, you know, to take control, and fix, you know, take the reins and so on. So that's the second step. That's all.
Yeah. I'm not sure that it's completely established that Kerensky was a Jew. I think there's a rumor that his father was an Austrian Jew named Adler.
Oh, do you think it's important?
Well, that's just to be precise, you know.
Because, you know, they used him and then they killed him too. He was one of those useful idiots, wasn't he, Kerensky?
Well, it depends. I mean, as I say, there is this, I'm not sure how much substantiation to it, but some people say that his father was a Jew and that he was a half-Jew.
Even if he was a half-Jew, it wouldn't mean that he was all for what the Bolsheviks were doing.
Well, that's true, but he was a socialist. And
yeah.
The thing is, you had this situation where the socialists, the Mensheviks, they'd established this St. Petersburg Soviet, St. Petersburg being the capital of Russia mm-hmm. at that time. And there was they had created enough chaos during the months between the first revolution and the time that the Bolsheviks took over that they actually created the chaos that the Bolsheviks needed to make it possible for them to take over.
Okay.
Well, anyway.
Sounds good.
So there's an argument there about whether Kerensky, how deliberate was Kerensky about this. He was the one that let the, if I recall correctly, he was the one that let the Bolsheviks back into the country. They had been exiled.
Mm. Okay, so he's one of those questionable characters.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. Did he do what he did deliberately, or was he just an idiot? Okay. But this seizure of a country, as was attempted in Germany, and as was not only attempted but succeeded in Russia, is not the end of the program. It is only the beginning of its open or public phase. The Soviet Kahal makes for the complete breaking up of society, the entire cutting off of cooperation and communication, the ruling of each little section in the way desired, until the whole country lies helpless in isolated bits. The process includes, of course, the disintegration of industry also, the massing of Gentiles into an army, and a general destruction of morality and order. It is the protocol program, in its last stage before the reconstruction begins, which shall make the conquered country a Jewish state.
Okay, now here, this is the third stage. Where industry and morality and order are completely broken down. Anyway, in the last stage, then the reconstruction begins to make the conquered country a Jewish state. Now, they're saying here that this is the goal, is to create. You have said in the past that you think they don't want that. That's why you don't like the term autocrat used for the Jews, and that you think they just like to stay in the disorder. But I would say that they are only using the disorder because their final objective, of course, is to make everything a Jewish state, and that's what they intended to do in the Soviet Union. In Russia.
See, the thing is, autocracy is very dangerous for the Jews because if you have a Jewish autocrat, the Jews get blamed for what happens.
But you're saying that, but that may not be the way they think.
Worry about this guy turning against them, which is arguably what Stalin did.
Well, see, now, but that's an argument you're making. But all we want to do is look at what they seem to be doing, and I think that their intention is control, and therefore I don't know whether it's an autocrat or not, but you know that they're going to run things out in the open as everything being Jewish, and everybody will have to follow, as they do sometimes already.
You think they want it to be known that Jews are running things?
Yeah, because then they will have control of everything. Oh, I think so.
That makes a very dangerous situation for them.
Well, they probably don't think that they're going to be in danger once they get all these things put in place. But, well, let's go on, and we can always talk about that if we have some time.
By the way, the USSR under Stalin was very different from what it had been before Stalin took over. He made a lot of things work, actually, which had been...
Oh, isn't he a hero? Oh, he's such a hero.
Well, a lot of people thought...
I know they do, and I don't think it should be encouraged.
All right. The world has not seen that last stage yet. It has not come even in Russia. If the Russian people waken from the days into which they have been thrust, it will not come. Jewish voices loudly proclaim that Soviet Russia has come to stay. The only authoritative voice on that subject is the voice of Russia, and Russia has not yet spoken. Today the world is trembling on the very verge of real Russia's awakening, and with it a retribution most terrible upon the Sovietists.
Well, see, now we do know, though, Russia has spoken, and the Russian people, I don't know if they woke up, but somehow fate determined that after so much time, it was overthrown. Although the Jews still have the overall financial power over everyone. So you can't say that they've been overthrown, but they're not in control of Russia at the moment at all like they were, would you say? I don't.
Well, the Jews had a lot of power after the end of the Soviet Union because they were in a position to rule through money.
Yeah, the Soviet state had largely commercial and financial and capitalism and so on, more than government rule.
Yeah, the Soviet state actually limited Jewish power quite a bit because it was not a place where you could just buy anything, apparently. But it seems that Putin has largely broken the power of the oligarchs, who were largely Jewish, as I understand. So
yeah, that's my impression. People, you know, want to dispute all kinds of conspiracy and, you know, bring in all kinds of conspiracy ideas, but I think that's pretty well.
And I think a large part of the reason for breaking down the Soviet Union, which the United States government went heavily into debt trying to do, you know, through the agitation of these neocon Jews, it was because the system wasn't good for Jews.
Yeah, I could go along with that.
It supported the Arabs against Israel. It wouldn't let the Jews leave and go to Israel, or restricted that.
Why wouldn't they want to kick those Jews out of there?
I don't know.
I never got interested in that. I can't.
Let some Jews emigrate.
About it since, you know, but. Yeah, but that whole thing, the Jews were just trying to get a whole lot of sympathy. But all their poor Russian Jews, they were suffering so much. You know, because they couldn't leave. Now that they can leave, nobody wants to go to Israel. You know, it's just such a big farce, the whole thing. Everything they do is.
The program of the protocols once came near succeeding in the French Revolution, but it is, but its essential immorality overreached itself. It has come a step nearer success in Russia, but there too its defiance of the moral law will be its undoing. The Jewish question of today is being fought out in Russia and Poland, and the strength of the Jewish forces is largely and mostly supplied from the United States of America. No wonder those small East European independencies which are fighting for their lives refer to our country as the land of the Jews. Now, here's a protocol for you to read.
Oh, yeah, Protocol 7. We will show our power to one,
say the protocols.
Okay. In order to demonstrate our enslavement of the Gentile governments of Europe, we shall show our power to one of them by crimes of violence, that is, by a reign of terror.
Protocol 7.
Now, what are they referring to there? France? Or something later, like Germany? And
well, that term reign of terror is originally associated with France.
I know. But I don't know what time, you know, this is what, well, this really should be after France. So it should be what they were going to do to the Germans, maybe. But they don't say.
All right. Maybe in Russia, more likely. But
maybe that.
One by one, the Gentile nations of Europe have been compelled to withdraw their troops from Russia because they had troops over there fighting after the First World War. One by one, the premiers of Europe have submitted to heavy shackling of their official hands with regard to the Russian question. And today the world looks on while little Poland, apparently the second country on the list of Soviet victims, is made to feel heavy vengeance for her daring to be independent of Jewish power. Russia has been made to pay for her attempted independence of the Jew. Poland is now being made to pay. It is a flame. The Jews of Eastern Europe hope, and many Jews of America also, which will sweep round the world. If the ruling Jews of the world wished the Russian people freed, if they wished the flames of Bolshevism to be quenched, if they wished Jewish participation in revolutionary movements to be withdrawn, they could accomplish it in a week. What is going on today is going on by permission of the Jewish world powers. There is apparently no desire to curtail a movement which largely originated in American Jewry. This is the program of showing our power to one, and the program will be followed out. The showing, however, is twofold. It is a showing of power, but it is also a showing of the people who wield the power. And in the end, it might have been just as well had the power never been coveted, attained, or used. Anyone who desires to test the exactitude of the protocol's estimate of human nature may do so by observing his own reactions to the Russian Bolshevist situation. It is undeniable that there exists among all classes of Gentiles in America a kind of admiration for the coup which Lenin and Trotsky have managed on such a massive scale. The audacity of it, the ability to stay afloat thus long in defiance of so many laws, have conspired to draw out unwilling applause. Consider then this passage from the 10th protocol.
The people feel an especial love and respect toward the genius who wields political power, and they say of all his high-handed actions, it is base but clever, it is a trick, but how he played it, so majestic, so impudent. Oh, continues. We count on attracting all nations to the constructive work of laying the foundation for the structure planned by us. It is necessary for us, first of all, to acquire the services of bold and fearless agents who will overcome all obstacles in our pathway. When we accomplish our governmental coup d'etat, we will say to the people, everything has gone badly. All have suffered. We will eliminate the cause of your sufferings. They are nationality, frontiers, and diversity of coinage. Of course, you are free to pronounce sentence upon us, but that can scarcely be just if you do so before giving a trial to that which we offer you. Ha! Yeah. Sounds like the European Union plan.
Well, I'll just point out there that this is what every populist dictator says, except for the solutions that are offered. You know, Adolf Hitler said, give us 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah. That's true, so, but he had made it clear what he wanted to do, but you do have to give people a chance. However, I've had liberals, back when I used to talk with liberals on internet things, and they would say what was something that, you know, they wanted to bring in, you know, it might have been Barack Obama or whatever, who, and, you know, it was like, oh, well, it wasn't actually that, but well, give it a chance, you know. Let's try it out, because see if it works. Well, we've already tried this. I'd point out that it already had been tried. It didn't work. It was known it doesn't work. But they were trying to use that silly argument, you know, that, oh, well, you know, just let's try this and see how it works.
Yeah.
Stupid.
There are many things that have been tried and are known not to work, but continue to be tried.
Yeah.
This is very well conceived, and this is the way in which, up to this time, it has worked out. But there will be a strong reaction set in. False promises like chickens come home to roost. The real originators, the real purpose of the movement hidden behind Bolshevism will become evident. And then the world will crush out again the world program, which at times has seemed so near success. There will probably be more light upon this world program as a result of the Russian Kahal Soviet system than from any other attempt to realize it. For five generations, the world has lived in a false light supposed to be shed by the French Revolution. It is now known that the revolution was not the revolution of the French people, but the disorders of a minority who sought to impose upon the French people the very plan which is now being considered. It was the French people who ultimately put down the so-called French Revolution. And France, as a result of that upheaval of a well-organized minority, has been bound by Jewish control ever since. I just want to point out here that the positive interpretation of the French Revolution really only started with Thomas Carlyle in 1837, and Dickens followed Carlyle, influenced by him. Before that, the French Revolution was called the Great Shipwreck of Civilization. It was considered a big disaster.
Even in France, or outside of France.
Yes, well, the French Revolution was not put on, it was known from the start that the majority of the French people had not wanted the French Revolution. It was done by Freemasons, most notoriously, and other organized radicals. It was Edouard Drumont in the late 19th century. He wrote some books arguing that the Jews were the real force behind the French Revolution. As I understand, I haven't really read Drumont, but there is there's a book based on Drumont called, I think it's called The Original Mr. Jacobs. And Revelo Oliver talks about that in one of his articles. The Russian Revolution will go down in history with no such false halo of romance about it. The world now knows it for what it is. The world will soon know whose was the money and whose were the brains that fostered it, and from what part of the world the principal impetus came. The Russian upheaval is racial, not political or economic. It conceals beneath all its false socialism and its empty mouthings of human brotherhood a clear-cut plan of racial imperialism, which is not Russian and which the common sense and interest of the world will speedily stamp out.
And there we come to the end for the first time in a long time, with time to spare, when instead of rushing to get it all in. So that's nice, because I'd like to comment on a couple of things here. First, well, right here at the end, he's talking about racial imperialism. They mean, of course, Jewish racial imperialism. And they are the biggest racial imperialists that you'll find anywhere. So if you want to look down on racialism, or, you know, you can look at it that way. I would agree with that. I would agree with it when it comes to the Jews, that they're really imperialistic about it. They do want to take away other people's rights to have to enjoy their race and to think well of their race. They want to be the only one that's in control. I do think so. But up here in the end of the other paragraph, they say, second to last, they say, in France, as a result of that upheaval of a well-organized minority, has been bound by Jewish control ever since. Well, they're saying that the French freed themselves, that the French people put down the revolution, and they kind of make it sound like it was a victory, but then they say that they've been bound by Jewish control ever since.
Yeah.
So what would you comment on that?
Well, you know, there was a very extreme circumstance for a while. You know, they had what they called the Reign of Terror. I mean, the original French Revolution, I wish I knew more about it to discuss it right now, but originally you had your bourgeois people that just wanted a constitutional monarchy. And then they got thrown over by a more radical faction, and then I think another more radical faction, until they were drowning people in rivers by the hundreds of thousands.
Yeah. You know. Sick. Oh.
And then you had a reaction, and you know, there was Charles X and his and another king that ruled for a while. And then they went to a republic again. I think that was the Second Republic. And then you had Napoleon III establishing the Second Empire, because I've left out Napoleon I. He established the First French Empire. And that evolved out of the French Revolution, because Napoleon Bonaparte had been a general on the revolutionary side. And there was such chaos that Napoleon sort of established order. You know, same principle that as the Bolshevik takeover.
So they're saying, like, the French people did, you know, they took them a while. They had a lot of different things going on, but they eventually settled down. But they are still now bound by Jewish control ever since then. So I think what they're meaning there is that when you have revolution, violent revolution like this, it's just a way for the Jews to get in control.
Well,
it's
really,
they
had a republican system where Jews could exert a deciding influence. That's really more like it.
Okay.
That's what we have.
And then, you know, the French Revolution sounds almost as bad as the Russian Revolution, but it's never thought about that way.
Yes.
You know,
it was until Carlyle wrote about it, and then Dickens.
They prettied it up. And I was looking at a painting just the other day by Delacroix, which I remember so well from my art student days, where we're out of town, but out of time. But he's, you know, glorifying the revolution, really. And that was in the 1860s he painted that.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for being with us tonight. And come back next week for our next chapter about the farm.
Rage, rage, I'm breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.